RN, your world unfolding.
Hello, thanks for joining me for Big Ideas this Wednesday evening here on RN or via the web at abc.net.au/radionational. I'm Paul Barclay. Tonight, the 13th annual Manning Clark Lecture delivered by Ramona Koval, lover of books, writer, journalist and former ABC broadcaster. Fascinated by the epic journeys of discovery undertaken by early 20th century polar explorers, Ramona vividly describes the adversity and challenges of daily life. She also expresses her admiration for those involved in Thor Heyerdahl's Kon-Tiki raft voyage across the Pacific Ocean in the late 1940s. So why do these heroic travellers' tales inspire her? Let's go now to the National Library in Canberra and join Ramona Koval as she presents the 2012 Manning Clark Lecture.
I've called this lecture Fire and Ice, on slow reading, being serious and following your nose. For many years I had my nose, and I have my nose, usually, every day, in a book, and I worked at honing a skill that gave me pleasure as well as insight and hopefully a little wisdom. That is, I became a slow reader. And by that I don't mean I took ages to finish a book. In fact, I began to be very efficient at finishing a book, but it means slow reading as the difference between slow food and fast food. I read a lot of books, I became an efficient reader, but I read every word and I became deeply serious about reading and writing and thinking about what I'd learned. I had an early model. Reading a book, my mother would stretch out in the lounge room on one of the deep purple divans that would be later made up into their beds, her soft body covered in a blanket, her attention taken solely by the pages between her hands. She was lost to us for that time, her mind occupied and whirring. I'm sure she must have read to me, but I can't remember what exactly it might have been. English was her fourth or fifth language, and it had been learned on the factory floor in the garment industry, so I imagine she wasn't as fluent then as she was to become. The books she read took her away from the life that she found to be sad and disappointing. She found solace in the pages, and sometimes she shared the ideas she'd found too. I slowly realised that reading was the key with which to open secret worlds, strange worlds, and the worlds behind other people's eyes. Much later, when I discovered the hidden promises of a toy microscope, the possibilities were similar. There was a hidden and fantastic world you could only see with a mechanism of the lens. I had the same thrill when I discovered the telescope too. And mastering the tools of reading, opened up possibilities. I've had conversations with some of the best writers in the world, and when people talk about their introduction to reading, which nearly always determines their impulse to writing, many will talk of the local library or librarian as the source of their lifelong love of books. For English novelist Jeanette Winterson, whose adoptive parents were fundamentalist Christians, they had 6 books at home, all of them to do with the Bible. Well, for her, the books from the library were her path to a world outside the tiny restricted subjects allowed by her parents. But everything she bought from the library was vetted by her mother, so she began to hide books under her bed. She was sprung with a copy of Women in Love. And her mother knew enough to know that D.H. Lawrence was a Satanist and a pornographer. So the mother threw all the books out of Jeanette's bedroom window and set fire to them in the backyard in front of the outside toilet. Now, that's what she said. I'm not sure whether that's exactly what happened, but it makes a good story. I often think, Jeanette Winterson told me, that the reason why tyrants hate books and how they do book burning sessions regularly and book banning is not so much what the books contain, but because reading itself is an act of free will. Nothing can come between you and the book. There's no surveillance camera, there's no little bugging device from the CIA that can get into that space between your mind and the page, so it's terrifying. And it does mean independence of mind and spirit. Nobody knows what you're thinking at that time. Now, my long-departed mother was completely different from Mrs. Winterson. She adored banned books and made it her business to read anything she could get. Philip Roth's Portnoy's Complaint, the aforementioned Lawrence's Lady Chatterley's Lover, they were all part of her couch reading reveries. Sometimes I wondered if we were going to get a knock on the door from the Vice Squad. I once asked her to get me a book that I'd heard about. How, I don't know, but I think it was mentioned as an adult joke on television. Anyway, I asked her to get it for me as I had the impression that it was very interesting. She wrote down the title on an envelope in her slow hand and took it into the city with her to collect after her doctor's appointment. She described how she passed the note over to a bookshop salesman saying, "My daughter wants to read this." And he, seemingly flustered, said, "How old is your daughter?" 12, she replied. The book is bought, and on the tram on the way back home, she takes it out of her paper bag and opens it up. She says the man opposite seems very surprised to see her reading the Kama Sutra on the number 48 tram to North Balwyn, a middle-class Melbourne suburb with very many churches. Presumably, after getting used to the flowery language of the ancient Indian Sanskrit sex manual, my dear mother was not fooled by the confusing categories of the hare man and the bull man and the horse man, according to the size of his lingam, and according to the depth of her yoni, the female categories of the deer, the mare, or the female elephant. She knew what was what, and realised that the chapters devoted to types of embraces and kissing and different kinds of marks to be made by nails and teeth were all possibly questionable as a subject for the 12-year-old mind. When I came home from school, there was a minor Spanish Inquisition to check if I had any idea what the book was about, and a marginally heightened exposition on how embarrassed she'd been, but to her credit, she let me take it into my room and try and make sense of it. Which was not easy, especially the puzzling chapter on women who stand in doorways or are always looking out onto the street. These were some of the women who were the most easily seduced. Was this manual simply a relic of another time and place, or were these truths universally held? How could I possibly know? But I learnt that if a woman who hears a man playing on a reed pipe, which has been dressed with the juices of six exotic plants, well, she becomes his slave. And I quote, "If the bone of a camel is dipped into the juice of the plant Eclipta prostrata and then burnt, and the black pigment produced from its ashes is placed in a box also made of the bone of a camel, and applied together with antimony to the eyelashes with a pencil also made with the bone of a camel, then that pigment is said to be very pure and wholesome for the eyes, and serves as a means of subjugating others to the person who uses it." How to get hold of camel bones and dressed reed pipes? Love certainly seemed a complex and mysterious art, but I thought that if a man tried to turn my head by furtively sprinkling a mixture over me of powdered thorns mixed with hogweed, monkey droppings and lily roots, I'd certainly notice the smell. After a varied career looking down microscopes and lecturing to eager and not-so-eager students, I worked for many years as a radio broadcaster, specialising in making sense of books. One of the highlights of the work, and one I do miss, was the torrent of books that came pouring into my office from all over the world. Did I become spoiled, blasé even, with the quality and quantity of works that were available to me? Certainly. But I noticed that there were some books that managed to survive my treatment of close reading, note-taking in margins and on the end papers at the back, and after the interviews, being offered to colleagues or charities or to friends. These made it back to the bookshelves in my home. So, inspecting my shelves, certain kinds of books stand together, and it's these collections that serve as the basis for a group of essays that I've been writing for a book called On Reading, to be published later in the year by Text. The shelves at home contain all kinds of things, from novels to poetry to biography to classics of all times, of all kinds of literary criticism and history. Of course, Manning Clark's magisterial six-volume History of Australia is there. But what were my books about exploration for? Why did I gravitate to explorers' journals and travellers' tales? I think it may have begun with the story of Robinson Crusoe. I'm sure I read one of the many abridged versions for children that followed the 1719 publication of Daniel Defoe's novel called The Life and Strange Surprising Adventures of Robinson Crusoe of York, Mariner, who lived 8 and 20 years all alone in an uninhabited island on the coast of America near the mouth of the great river of Orinoco, having been cast on shore by shipwreck, wherein all the men perished but himself, with an account of how he was at last, as strangely, delivered by pirates. I like the way they just told you everything and you knew whether you're going to like that book or not. It certainly wasn't a girl's book. And I was brought up in an era when the chasm of what was expected of girls and boys was wide. I borrowed it from the school library and it was covered with that thick but transparent plastic covering that books had in those days. And the smell that comes into my mind's nose is a cross between linoleum and sellotape. In the original, there's a lot that happens between Robinson Crusoe going to sea against the wishes of his father, his subsequent adventures, both enslaved and on the hunt for slaves at various points, and his being shipwrecked on the island alone and with, as Defoe writes, nothing about me but a knife, a tobacco pipe, and a little tobacco in a box. Until he makes a raft and starts returning to the submerged ship for supplies. It's at this point that my interest peaked, because even the episode in which he discovers the ritual cannibalism of the visiting savages or the footprint in the sand after he's been alone for many months. Man Friday, of course, although a welcome human companion, didn't hold the fascination for me that Robinson Crusoe's predicament presented. How do you survive on a desert island? Crusoe had the ship, and various weather and tidal events helped him salvage all kinds of things from the wreckage. But how clever he was in making use of such objects. His building of a home, a fort, and a ladder to pull up behind him as he secured his realm from attacks. His observation of the discarded rat-eaten grains of dust, which almost miraculously yielded a few stalks of grain-bearing grasses, and his patience and perseverance in harvesting and replanting them to cultivate his own stock of barley and corn from which he might finally, in some long-distant future, make himself some delicious bread. He says, "And yet here I was perplexed again, for I neither knew how to grind or make meal of my corn, or indeed how to clean it and part it, nor if made into meal, how to make bread of it, and if how to make it, yet I knew not how to bake it." While luck might set out the primary conditions and patience and perseverance so hard to muster were vital to any serious attempt at survival, would I ever have the luck and the perseverance and the patience not to gobble the grains there and then, but to wait for the time when I could mill the grain and bake the bread? I'm reminded of Robinson Crusoe and his handy raft as I open my copy of Thor Heyerdahl's 1951 edition of the Kon-Tiki expedition by raft across the South Seas. Who can fail to be seduced by the warm and humorous tone of his translated prose and his introduction, which takes place in the middle of the action, telling the story exactly as advised by the ancient poet Horace. It is 1947 and Heyerdahl is on a balsa wood raft in the Pacific Ocean, having found 7 flying fish on deck, 1 squid on the cabin roof, and 1 unknown fish in Torstein's sleeping bag. Very convenient, because he's the cook for that day. Now he's writing in his damp logbook, on which is perched a green parrot, and one of his bearded companions is reading Goethe in the cabin off to his side. Now, for me, that is an absolutely irresistible entree into the book, which proceeds with all the good nature and detail and character analysis and storytelling that I love. Now, his idea was essentially this. Peruvian Inca legends told of a sun king called Contiki who ruled over white people with beards who were called big ears because they elongated their earlobes to reach their shoulders. These people built the giant statues in the Andes Mountains, before they were defeated by the Incas in battle. And then they set off westwards on balsa wood rafts from Peru. Now, on Rapa Nui, or Easter Island, on the way from Peru to Polynesia, they tell a story of Tiki, who, along with white long-eared companions, came to the island from the east, that's where Peru is, skilled in the crafting of exactly the same statues which they erected there. Now, in Polynesia, the story was of Tiki, who had come from the east across the sea in rafts from a place called Pura. Sounds like Peru, from where the sun rose. And it all made marvellous sense. The only thing missing was that no one had ever written about or even heard of a balsa wood raft sailing from Peru to Polynesia. So Heyerdahl thought, why not try it? So with five able companions who volunteer for the expedition as if they're in a 1930s movie with Mickey Rooney, eager to put on a show of their own, he gets going. The absurd daring do of getting the raft together and sailing off, which ends luckily in no lives lost and a party on a Polynesian island complete with hula girls, for a time gives Heyerdahl some heartening confirmation that his theory about how sailors from Peru settled the Polynesian islands using their balsa wood rafts, well, might stand up to scrutiny. He was a very happy man. Sadly, since mitochondrial DNA analysis has now been done on the populations of Polynesia, there is evidence that many of the islands were in fact settled from Asian travellers coming from the west using the occasional reversal of the prevailing monsoonal winds, which Heyerdahl didn't know about at the time. But there are South American gene markers there too. Anyway, for many of my male friends, Thor Heyerdahl was a childhood hero, the embodiment of what the Boy Scouts were about, you know, the boys who built a raft and went voyaging on the high seas. And for me, a girl with no brothers and no uncles and a fairly distant relationship with my father, the six men on the raft are absolutely fascinating glimpses into the mysteries of men. And as a nervous traveller, one who fights against the panic of packing because I might not pack exactly what I need to bring, nothing impresses me more than the planning required for a trip like this. So as usual, I'm interested in what they packed. And this is from the book. As Eric had brought several rolls of drawing paper and a guitar, his box was so full that he had to put his stockings in Torstein's box. Then four naval ratings came along carrying Bent's box. He brought nothing but books, but he had managed to cram in 73 sociological and ethnological works. Now, Bent was Bent Danielson, who you might remember went on to campaign against French nuclear testing in the Pacific into his very old age. This is all on a raft, six blokes on a raft, with all of these ethnological and sociological works. Now, I'm not sure when I discovered a whole class of books that took these ideas of remote survival even further, but I began to read accounts of the pioneering anthropologists of the 20th century, but I really wanted to read of voyages, not merely travels, like those of Fridtjof Nansen, the father of modern polar exploration, a Norwegian polymath who was a central nervous system biologist, an oceanographer, an historian, and finally a diplomat. He ended his career working for the League of Nations as High Commissioner for both refugees and for the repatriation of prisoners of war from the First World War. Using his diaries and letters, Nansen's biographer, Roland Huntford, paints a picture of a moody, dogged man who had to invent so many things before he could even undertake his voyages across Greenland or towards the North Pole. In Nansen's own 1897 account of his voyage, called Farthest North, being the record of a voyage of exploration of the ship Fram, 1893 to 1896, he declares, "The spirit of mankind will never rest till every spot of these regions has been trodden by the foot of man, till every enigma has been solved." Now, this guy was extraordinary. He had to adapt cross-country skiing techniques, which no one thought would be successful for his trip across Greenland. He designed not only the ship he used, but a lightweight sledge. He designed the clothing they needed for trekking. He designed sleeping bags, even a spirit stove. The pure alcohol needed to run it was also drinkable, but he was really concerned that his party not debauch themselves. So he turned it into methylated spirits and had to sort of work out how that was going to work. And further, he was such a control freak that he took control by cooking everything himself for the whole group. His diaries show him to be riven by his ambitions on the one hand and by his inability to achieve things to the level he required on the other. As I said, he could be difficult and gloomy, but I love this description by a Norwegian businessman, Jonas Lied. This is how he describes Fridtjof Nansen. Sad, even when enthusiastic. Mirthless, even when eager. And yet, gloomy and all, he convinces an assortment of men to follow him, sometimes on trips that last years. As I said, he disapproves of the men's drinking and debauching, even on their very last night in port before setting off. He was passionate about preparation and about the need for careful scientific observations on a variety of projects. And in turn, he read accounts of the failures of his predecessors and disapproved of the rush in which they'd planned and equipped their trips. He took 9 years in the conceptual framing and 3 years to plan. This, I think you'll agree, is serious thought and serious planning.
On RN, I'm Paul Barclay. You're listening to Big Ideas. Tonight, the 13th annual Manning Clark Lecture, Fire and Ice, on slow reading, being serious and following your nose. Let's head back now to the National Library in Canberra. Here's Ramona Koval.
Now, I always had a romantic vision of the sledge and the dogs pulling it. And I now realise this sprung from seeing the film Dr. Zhivago with my mother, which led to my studying Russian for a year when I was 15. I'd bought the Communist Manifesto and thought it all sounded marvellous, and my mother gave me some poems by Yevtushenko, but really I wanted more than anything I realise now to be Julie Christie, in furs, beautiful and cosy and pulled through the snow with an adoring Omar Sharif, minus the moustache, by my side. Not for the first time I found I was prone to mixing up the erotic life with books and self-improvement. So much so was the pull of this vision that 10 years ago I found myself behind a team of 7 Alaskan huskies at South River in the Algonquin State Park, north of Toronto in Canada. Part of me wanted to line the sled like Julie Christie, but it was filled to the brim with camping gear and food for humans and dogs. I did ride it on the way back with depleted supplies and hypothermia, but that's another story. But there I met a little dog called Jose, small but determined, who led the 7-dog team and taught me lessons about bravery and humour and sheer pluck, and that appearances are not all they seem, and that even the most courageous of us has little foibles which make us, well, human? Well, not exactly. Let's say vulnerable. I remember reading other accounts of snowy landscapes in order to pick up invaluable hints at survival. Instructing was John McPhee, a New Yorker essayist and adventurer, who reported in his book Coming Into the Country a meeting with Leon Crane, who'd survived a plane crash in the Alaskan wilderness and who emerged long after people had given him up for dead. Now, when Crane crashed, he was wearing a hooded down jacket, a sweater, winter underwear, 2 pairs of trousers, 2 pairs of socks, and felt-lined military mukluks. Mukluks, I had to look it up. Sealskin boots. Where was I going to get a seal at this late stage? Crane had 2 boxes of matches, a Boy Scout knife. He started a fire with a letter from his father. It was his parachute that kept him alive. 28 feet in diameter, he wound it around him so he was the centre of a great cocoon. Of course, I'd neglected to take a sheaf of letters from my father, and I hadn't seen a 28-foot diameter parachute in any of my shopping expeditions. But I met the dogs on a vast snow-covered paddock where they're housed in blue, green and yellow barrels, and they bark when they see the car and a new group ready to set out. "Pick me," they seem to say as they strain on their chains. So 7 dogs are harnessed, the lead dog at the front. Jose was a fairly unprepossessing black cream and white dog, not too big and very enthusiastic. The lead dogs are clipped at the head of the main line, then the point dogs in the middle section and the wheel dogs at the back. The guy says that the lead dogs are the smartest, but he says it in a quiet voice as if the wheel dogs are going to be offended if they knew we were speaking like this. But the truth is the wheel dogs are used to following their leaders and have a tendency to get themselves all mixed up and the line tangled. Now that's really, really a mess if that happens. It's like having your car's universal joint break down. It's really surprisingly complex to run a dog team, and you have to deal with personality clashes and moodiness amongst the dogs. Cinder refused to work in the team, didn't want to run, was then clipped on the back of the sled because he didn't like the major snowmobile roads. But when we moved onto a narrow track of powdery snow, he refused again. He had to be swapped with one of the dogs from the team behind. Sometimes doesn't like to be in the front sled, likes to be in the second sled. Jose, though, was a crab runner. He was fantastic, but I was surprised at the lack of physical presence as he dragged the load through the landscape. I remember thinking then of Amundsen, who you'll remember successfully reached the South Pole 5 weeks earlier than Robert Falcon Scott. The short version, of course, is that Scott relied on technology and took tractors which broke down, while Amundsen had a team of trusty dogs which got him to his destination and fed him on the way back. This is how he puts it in his 1912 book, The South Pole, an account of the Norwegian Antarctic expedition in the Fram, 1910 to 1912. He says, "And then there is the obvious advantage that dog can be fed on dog. One can reduce one's pack little by little, slaughtering the feebler ones and feeding the chosen with them. In this way they get fresh meat. Our dogs lived on dog's flesh and pemmican the whole way, and this enabled them to do splendid work. And if we ourselves wanted a piece of fresh meat, we could cut off a delicate little fillet. It tasted to us as good as the best beef. The dogs do not object at all. As long as they get their share, they do not mind what part of their comrade's carcass it comes from. All that was left after one of these canine meals was the teeth of the victim. And if it had been a really hard day, these also disappeared." This account appeared very matter-of-fact, even quite jolly. But Jose, running his heart out at the head of the team, didn't look particularly appetising to me. Fridtjof Nansen writes of his first lame attempts at driving a sledge with 10 dogs. He says, "No sooner were we ready and I had taken my seat than the team caught sight of a wretched strange dog that had come near, and off dashed dog, sledge and my valuable person after the poor creature. There was a tremendous uproar. All the 10 tumbled over each other like wild wolves, biting and tearing wherever they could catch hold. Blood ran in streams and the culprit howled pitiably. I sat passively on the sledge in the middle of it all, dumb with fright, and it was ever so long before it occurred to me that there was perhaps something for me to do too. With a horrible yell, I flung myself on some of the worst fighters, got hold of them by the neck, and managed to give the culprit time to get away. We went on board again, well satisfied, also the richer by a new experience, having learnt that dog driving, at any rate to begin with, requires much patience. How much less sanguine I would have been on that Canadian dog sledding trip if I'd read Nansen's account of the dogs before I read Amundsen. When times were happy and the hard work was still to come, the dogs were joyous, rolling in the snow and made a cheerful sight. But later in Volume 2, as things got harder, Nansen and his partner Johansson had to strangle a number of the dogs and butcher them in order to feed the survivors. He says, "When this first dog was dismembered and given to the others, many of them went supperless and the whole night in preference to touching the meat. But as the days went by and they became more worn out, they learned to appreciate dog's flesh. And later we were not even so considerate as to skin the butchered animal, but served it hair and all." I guess this is the meaning of the phrase dog eat dog world, and the behaviours of the dogs as they hounded other weaker animals and set upon them in a pack underlied the stark reality of what survival really means. As they neared the next part of the trip, a final decision had to be made. He says, It was sad to think we could not take our two last dogs with us, but we should probably have no further use for them, and it would not have done to take them with us on the decks of our kayaks. We were sorry to part with them, and we'd become very fond of these two survivors. Faithful and enduring, they had followed us the whole journey through, and now the better times had come, they must say farewell to life. Destroy them in the same way as the others, we could not. We sacrificed a cartridge on each of them. I shot Johansson's and he shot mine. So there is sadness in the journals and a real attachment to the dogs. Johansson returned from the Fram expedition in 1896, but against my expectations, the men did not forge a lasting friendship. Johansson had felt slighted by his old expedition leader, and he later joined Amundsen's 1911 venture to the Antarctic. But he had a falling out with Amundsen over drinking and insubordination, and the expedition left without him. He was paid off and sent home, and when Nansen heard that Johansson had shot himself in January 1913, he said that in the Arctic, Johansson had been the right man in the right place. I adore these shivering stories of men pitted against the elements because they're ripe with tragedy and bravery and human nature under extremes of pressure, and they're romantic too. You can visit the ship Discovery, which took Scott to the Antarctic in 1901 to 1904, at Dundee on the east coast of Scotland. I'm not sure if you've been there, but when I was there, I found it completely absorbing for the few hours it took to examine every part of the exhibition and press every button and listen to every soundscape of the wind and the snow. You can go aboard the ship and see the specially designed and crested expedition crockery and the brass bars outside the around the outside of the dining table to stop it smashing off the surface in a storm. Scott imposed British Royal Naval procedures, which meant officers eating separately on the ship from the men, and it continued in Antarctica while they were frozen in ice for the 2 years down there. They kept it up, an officers' mess, officers' clubs, officers' quarters. The officers had certain privileged liquors and alcohol. They had cigars while the others had cigarettes. And there was this class distinction that ran through the entire expedition. You can see the thin leather clothing that the men wore in freezing conditions. Today, no self-respecting bikie would wear such little protection in temperate weather. You can read the menu for the 22nd of June 1903, turtle soup, halibut cutlets, plum pudding and jellies, and read about the harmonium presented by the people of Christchurch on their way south. A copy of Gulliver's Travels is on display, a present from Sir Clements Markham, who launched Scott's career. There was also he was also the man to whom Scott wrote in the last days of his life. But the story of the ill-fated Terra Nova expedition of 1910 to 1913, as told in Scott's journal, starts full of yearning for adventure, for knowledge, and for pride in being English. Scott says, "We're all adventurers here, I suppose, and wild doings in wild countries appeal to us as nothing else could do. It is good to know that there remain wild corners of this dreadfully civilised world." There are details about how the men spent their days in readiness for their last strike out for the pole, the southern journey, with each man taking turns giving lectures on their specialities. Oates on feeding the horses, Wilson on sketching, Atkinson on parasitology, Debenham on volcanoes, and Wright on ice problems. There's a bitter sweetness about the massive preparations and, of course, an innocence of the tragic outcome of the subsequent expedition. There is Scott's poetic sensibility, and because people have the impression that Scott is formal and full of stiff upper-lipped attitude of empire, I wanted to share this with you. This is what he writes under the title Impressions. The seductive folds of the sleeping bag. The hiss of the primus and the fragrant steam of the cooker issuing from the tent ventilator. The small green tent and the great white road. The whine of a dog and the neigh of our steeds. The driving cloud of powdered snow. The crunch of footsteps which break the surface crust. The wind-blown furrows. The blue arch beneath the smoky cloud. The crisp ring of the pony's hooves. And the swish of the following sledge. The droning conversation of the march as driver encourages or chides his horse. The patter of dog pads, the gentle flutter of our canvas shelter, its deep booming sound under the full force of a blizzard, the drift snow like finest flour penetrating every hole and corner, flickering up beneath one's head, covering, pricking sharply as a sandblast, the sun with blurred image peeping shyly through the wreathing drift, giving pale shadowless light, the eternal silence of the great white desert, cloudy columns of snowdrift advancing from the south, pale yellow wraiths heralding the coming storm, blotting out one by one the sharp cut lines of the land. The blizzard, nature's protest, the crevice, nature's pitfall, that grim trap for the unwary. No hunter could conceal his snare so perfectly. The light rippled snow bridge gives no hint or sign of the hidden danger. Its position unguessable till man or beast is floundering, clawing and struggling for foothold on the brink, the vast silence broken only by the mellow sounds of the marching column. But there's also a certain restraint to Scott's journal entries and overconfidence in his strategies of using horses and motor sledges. Reading it brings your heart to your mouth as the cheery tone gets rapidly despondent after the realisation that Amundsen has got to the pole first and left him a letter. And it says, "Dear Captain Scott, as you probably are the first to reach this area after us, I will ask you to kindly forward this letter to King Haakon VII, that's the Norwegian king. If you can use any of the articles left in the tent, please do not hesitate to do so. The sledge left outside may be of use to you. With kind regards, I wish you a safe return. Yours truly, Roald Amundsen." What did Amundsen mean about the letter for the King of Norway? Was it a snide reference to Scott being his servant now that he's been bested at the pole? Scott had said he was on a scientific expedition rather than a race, and indeed there were 32 pounds of geological specimens that the doomed men had hauled back with them for the cause of science. But how did he really take the news? The weather turned worse, the men faltered with illness and lack of provisions. And then Captain Oates, of course, left the tent. "I'm just going outside and maybe some time," were his parting words to the men he wanted to save, after accepting that he was no longer able to walk and therefore endangered their chances. The three he left behind died a couple of weeks later, only a few miles short of their goal, one-ton depot, 11 miles away. Imagine the scene of Scott writing till the last, messages to the men's families and pleas for the care of his wife and child. His mentor, Sir Clements Markham, writes in the introduction to Scott's last expedition, "The great leader with the bodies of his dearest friends beside him wrote and wrote until the pencil dropped from his dying grasp. There was no thought of himself, only the earnest desire to give comfort and consolation to others in their sorrow. His very last lines were written lest he who induced him to enter upon Antarctic work should now feel regret for what he had done. If I cannot write to Sir Clements, tell him I thought much of him and never regretted him his putting me in command of the Discovery." Scott did set up in circumstances that in some ways made it likely that he was going to die on that return journey because of poor management. But he was a hero in the sense that he wrote a story that lasted, that came back to civilization, and that has inspired people ever since. There is romance in this pursuit of an abstract goal, because actually there's nothing to see in that era at the South Pole to distinguish it from any other part of the polar plateau. You know, you were going to find a spot in a vast desert and you had to get to it, and it looked just exactly like everything else that you could see. It's a amazing, bizarre kind of notion. It's a different tone from the later writings of Ernest Shackleton, who was along with the Discovery Expedition with Scott but was sent home for ill health in the middle of an expedition, which he felt to be a personal failure. He certainly made up for it later, and his memoir South, the story of Ernest Shackleton's last expedition, tells of another journey that didn't strictly succeed in its aims, but along the way you get a fantastic story not only of endurance and wit and leadership psychology, but for me, the details with which he relates the parameters of the problems to be solved and the strategies to solve them differentiate him from the other accounts. To give poor Scott his due, his were notes that were made under terrible conditions, and Shackleton's book was written and published a few years after their return. Shackleton, who'd been a journalist and a public lecturer, was a much more modern and energetic writer. And you might first think that there's a lot of ice in this book, but that then you realise that Shackleton is giving you an ice education. There's even an ice glossary, pancake ice, hummocky flows, growlers, to name a few. You learn stuff like old seal bones can be dug up and stewed down in seawater when things get tough. That blubber is good for making lamps and for eating. That one of the last things in Shackleton removed from the sinking ship Endurance was a banjo. And that the men left on Elephant Island under the two upturned boats had a concert every Saturday night, each of them singing a song about another member of the party. Now, I'm certainly taking South with me if I ever voyage beyond the south coast of Tasmania, as much for the recipes for sea blubber as adventure. Shackleton took to rearranging the weekly menu because the possible number of permutations of seal meat was decidedly limited. And because the men didn't know what meal was coming that night, this was apparently useful to surprise them. They knew it was all about seal, but they didn't know exactly what kind of seal. And the joy with which the rescue is depicted is palpable too. When he reaches the whaling station with two men, his first night in a room with an electric light and warm, soft beds is so comfortable and so exciting that he says he wasn't able to sleep. He stayed up all night. And what did the men have to read on the expedition after the Endurance became trapped and 9 months later was crushed by ice and sank beneath the crust? A portion of the Encyclopaedia Britannica. Which bit? Well, the bit that has descriptions of American towns and full and complete biographies of every American statesman since George Washington. A few books on Antarctic exploration, Browning poems, and The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. One man had a small penny cookery book, and from this he would read out one recipe each night, says Shackleton, so as to make them last. The men were obsessed with puddings, like Spotted Dog, with donuts, and with Scotch shortbread. Reading Amundsen's The South Pole, I'm aware that his proud account of his success at reaching the pole was written in Brisbane in the months after his return. He was to embark on a series of worldwide lectures, and he was very much buoyed by his sense that he had the right approach, the right equipment, and perhaps the right nationality to have succeeded. Very proud. In the introduction to the book, Fridtjof Nansen says, "For the victory is not due to the great inventions of the present day," i.e. a bit of a dig at Scott, "and the many new appliances of every kind. The means used are of immense antiquity, the same as were known to the nomad thousands of years ago when he pushed forward across the snow-covered plains of Siberia and northern Europe. But everything great and small was thoroughly thought out and the plan was splendidly executed. It is the man that matters here as everywhere." I wondered if the book would have had such a tone, proud and challenging to the follies of the other party, if they'd known that the bodies of Scott and his companions lay dead in the ice, Scott's journal frozen to his very chest. When the world learned of their fate and the bodies were found in late 1912, opinion turned against the Norwegians, and Amundsen was accused of being underhanded by switching the North Pole expedition to a South Pole expedition without telling anyone until he was well on the way. Some in the Royal Geographical Society back in London thought Amundsen had tricked Scott. And after Amundsen addressed them in 1912, the Society's president, Lord Curzon, called, "Three cheers for the dogs!" after which Amundsen resigned his membership. Apsley Cherry Garrard's 1922 account, The Worst Journey in the World, is another view of the Scots' fateful expedition, which starts with so much charm. He says, "Polar exploration is at once the cleanest and most isolated way of having a bad time which has been devised. It is the only form of adventure in which you put on your clothes at Michaelmas and keep them on until Christmas and, save for a layer of the natural grease of the body, find them as clean as though they were new. It is more lonely than London, more secluded than any monastery, and the post comes but once a year. As men will compare the hardships of France and Palestine or Mesopotamia, so it would be interesting to contrast the rival claims of the Antarctic as a medium of discomfort." His winter journey made with two others, Bertie Bowers and Edward Wilson, was in order to obtain emperor penguin embryos to study. Scott's first expedition was the first to find emperor penguin rookeries. The flightless birds were thought to be an ancient model on the way from reptiles to birds in the evolutionary march. It bred in the middle of winter, unlike any other bird, in the middle of the worst season in the most desolate part of the planet. And he writes about, the description of finding the emperor and going off to find an egg. This journey where he embarked in total darkness with temperatures down to 75 below, the coldest that had ever been recorded in human history at the time. They trek for 70 miles in their thin gabardine outfits, man-hauling the sleds, which were loaded with 3/4 of a ton of research equipment and their supplies. The idea was to get the fresh penguin embryos and dissect them in a laboratory that they were going to construct, building a stone hut that they could heat and work in. They decided also to use this trek to test the perfect diet for the polar attempt the next summer, so they divided up the types of food to test: biscuits, pemmican, and butter, and each ate a different proportion of fats to protein to carbohydrates. It was so cold their teeth chattered so much that some of them shattered. And after 5 weeks, they finally brought 3 emperor penguin eggs back to the expedition camp. And, of course, what happened to those penguin eggs? And he tells this story, which I'll just summarise. He takes these penguin... You can see how hard it was to get these penguin eggs. And he treks back. He was in the search party that found the body of Scott and his own winter journey companions, Bowers and Wilson. They all died. When he returned from the pole, he suffered long and serious mental illness, post-traumatic stress disorder, probably we'd call it today. But he goes off to deliver these eggs to the Natural History Museum in South Kensington. It's 1913. He's written to say he's going to bring the eggs. And he arrives and the guy says, "Well, who are you? What do you want? This ain't an egg shop. What call have you come meddling with our eggs? Do you want me to put the police onto you?" Anyway, they're completely unimpressed with this egg. I mean, after all this journey he's taken. His biographer, Sarah Wheeler, paints a picture of a passionate but shy man who at 50 courted his 20-year-old bride-to-be, Angela Turner, by giving her a stone on a beach. Years later, says Wheeler, when she had become an Antarctic expert as well, she discovered that the courtship ritual of the penguin centres around stone giving. Stones being a vital commodity for the construction of a nest. And it's the sweetness of Apsley Cherry Garrard that makes his account so readable. So I learnt reading all this that I had immense admiration for people who were serious in their quests, serious in their preparations, serious in the way they gave the time to their investigations, whether it was to take months or years, whether the travel was going to be hard or ask much of them, sometimes asking everything of them. And like my explorer heroes, I wish to take time and think deeply and read widely and consider the possibilities. It was an approach that was welcome in the home away from home that I found myself happy in for over 20 years at the National Broadcaster. But times change, sometimes for the better and sometimes not. I'm all for high-tech things and online worlds and the world of fast answers to a million questions. Indeed, sitting at home, writing and Googling gives me immense pleasure. I think of how long it would take to go to a library and get amongst the stacks and find out what I'm after, compared to pressing a series of buttons on my computer, and I'm staggered at what's possible these days. I know there's something lost in not being able to wander amongst things that you didn't know you were looking for, but you can still do that if you're curious and a dilettante. But the dangerous aspect of what passes for journalism today is the assumption that being serious and thorough means being boring, that a deep analysis of a policy instead of yet another leadership challenge story or a lost shoe outside a Canberra restaurant, that a serious conversation is going to lose people's attention, and that even if a serious matter is to be covered, we can only afford a few minutes or a few paragraphs before we're assailed with something more exciting or more popular. For me, there is great admiration and pleasure to be had in the close observation of one thing taught by someone who has immersed themselves in it for life. There's a film on at the moment, a documentary essay in a sense, called Buck, about a man whose whole life has been the training of horses. He's a horse whisperer, and to see him work and to see his life and how his knowledge and wisdom has been hard won is to step back in admiration for him and to value what he's learned. I saw another documentary recently on the Béjart Ballet of Lausanne. Gilles Roman, the successor of Maurice Béjart, who started the company and who trained his successor over many years, Gilles Roman was about to reveal the first performance that he'd produce without Béjart, and it was an exciting moment, and it was a very worrying moment for him, but he said something that resonated with me. He said that an ambience is a fragile thing. An ambience is a fragile thing. Like love, it's hard to describe, hard to keep alive, and devastatingly lost when it's gone. Culture has an ambience too, and the parts of culture we value, the passion, the being serious, the following our noses into new and magical realms, the depths we can reach, the fire and the ice, these things we must hold precious because an ambience is a fragile thing and heroes are required to keep it alive. I want to read you a poem by one of my favourite poets called Wisława Szymborska, Polish poet who died on the 1st of February 2012 in Kraków. She was 88. And this poem is called The End and the Beginning. After every war, someone has to clean up. Things won't straighten themselves up after all. Someone has to push the rubble to the sides of the road so the corpse-laden wagons can pass. Someone has to get mired in scum and ashes, sofa springs, splintered glass and bloody rags. Someone must drag in a girder to prop up a wall. Someone must glaze a window, rehang a door. Photogenic it's not and takes years. All the cameras have left for another war. Again we'll need bridges and new railway stations. Sleeves will go ragged from rolling them up. Someone, broom in hand, still recalls how it was. Someone listens and nods with unsevered head, yet others milling about already find it dull. From behind the bush, sometimes someone still unearths rust-eaten arguments and carries them to the garbage pail. Those who knew what was going on here must give way to those who know little and less than little, and finally, as little as nothing. In the grass which has overgrown reasons and causes, someone must be stretched out, blade of grass in his mouth, gazing at the clouds. This disintegration of a culture of seriousness is a bit like a war. And if there isn't anyone here to remember how things fit together, we are much the poorer. This is not an argument against change, but an argument for change, with full knowledge and mastery of the intellectual landscape in which we find ourselves. As Goethe said, he who cannot draw on 3,000 years is living hand to mouth. Thanks for listening.
Fire and Ice, on Slow Reading, Being Serious and Following Your Nose. That was Ramona Koval, writer, journalist and former ABC broadcaster, delivering the 13th annual Manning Clark Lecture. Our thanks to Ramona and Sebastian Clark and Judith Crisp from Manning Clark House, the National Library in Canberra, and ABC sound recordist Lisa Berenger for their help in making this broadcast possible. Love to hear your thoughts about tonight's and recent Big Ideas discussions. You can post your comments online at abc.net.au/radionational. Follow the prompts to Big Ideas. You can also download or stream the program or subscribe to our podcasts. I'm Paul Barclay. Hope you can join me tomorrow night for more Big Ideas here on RN, when I'll present the next in our series of conversations with Europe, commemorating 50 years of Australia-EU relations. Bye for now.